Thanks, Rob.
Big Bulls win. There you go. Six in a row. We'll take that. Yes.
Download 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. Coming up in the 10 o'clock hour, Studio 435. Big Sadie. Country Christmas. We're going to be at the Hideout on Thursday night. And the... I what do you call them, Pete? I've got acoustic American roots music. Maybe a little country. I mean, they call their show Country Christmas. But Country Christmas... And we had him in here before. You got a banjo, you got an upright bass, you got a fiddle, guitar. It's good stuff. It's acoustic jam. So it'll be fun tonight. I'm looking forward to having them in here to sing holiday songs. Country Christmas coming up in the 10 o'clock hour. I mean, come on, who does that? Country Christmas. I mean, Patty's got Clarinet Christmas, which is coming up in her show. I heard the promo. So there you go.
Like a Johnny Cash, Dolly Parton throwback kind of situation.
And in that same spirit, I'm going to be whiskeys in.
Yeah. Oh, that's a Kris Kristofferson Christmas, actually. That's a little different.
A little different. All right. So, you know, we've been talking about this all night. Scott Smith in studio, our new media contributor here to The Download. We're going to talk a little bit about social media news today, including Twitter and their crackdown, but also a question about what to look for when we talk about digital news in 2018. Scott joins us on the regular. He's the editorial director.
That's right. Over at Teamworks Media.
Yeah. Good to see you, buddy. Thanks for being here. Happy holidays.
Always good to be here.
All right. So let's get right to the social media stuff. This kind of went in one ear, out the other, but it's kind of the first big move for Twitter to crack down on hate speech and, I guess, incendiary tweets, both, and I thought this was really interesting, both in the tweets, but also in the profile, the profile names, so what you name your Twitter account. Mm-hmm. They're actually responding to the kind of, I guess, the all the dirt that's online right now and gets dusted up when things happen in this country.
Yeah, I mean, they've deleted some accounts before. I mean, Chuck Johnson was kind of famously kicked off Twitter. Milo was famously kicked off Twitter, one of the alt-right guys. So they've kind of done it on a piece-by-piece way. And now they are trying to create new rules around the kinds of things you can and can't say. And so, you know, anything that could be considered hate speech or threatening or, you know, singling out specific groups, rolled these rules out. And today was supposed to be the great... the great alt-right purge.
Right.
And it kind of wasn't. You know, there were a few accounts, most famously a couple of the people that had been a part of the Britain First movement, which is a very far-right, nationalist, Nazi-ish kind of account. It was sort of well-known because the president
retweeted
some videos.
These are the Muslim videos that came out a couple weeks ago,
So... you know, a couple of very high profile folks there, and then, you know, a couple of other people here and there, but it sort of remains to be seen whether, you know, the Richard Spencers of the Twitter universe, the sort of alt-right, the kind of, you know, pretty boy Nazi types are actually going to be affected by
and
this.
And I thought it was interesting, too, that they put in the language of what they would consider when they're considering banning people from the platform is what you do outside of Twitter. Before, there was this idea that you could be anything, you could do anything, and if you behaved yourself on the platform, who are they to judge? But they have changed that, and they're saying if you are a leader of a hate group or you're not on Twitter, we're not going to let you on this platform.
One of the complaints that people have had about the way that Twitter has approached this kind of thing before is that these folks would hide behind the idea that they aren't necessarily inciting hate, inciting violence, but they would use their different ways of interacting with people to kind of sic followers on a particular person, knowing that those people would then end up, you know, saying all kinds of hateful things against them. And they would say, well, look, I didn't actually tell them to do it. I didn't actually say it. But, you know, everyone knew the way in which they might at a particular person or, you know, quote tweet a particular person, that they knew kind of what they were doing. So... this is, I think, one of the steps in order to get them to try to crack down on some of the people who are in the, you know, inciting the various Twitter mobs. The one problem is that this, you know, singles out maybe some of the higher profile folks, but, you know, it's really easy to continue to create additional profiles and, you know, dump, you know, almost like burner profiles, right?
Yeah.
You dump a profile, and then you start up another one. So that kind of stuff, how do you end up creating
and I mean,
rules
I would
that?
I would assume, I mean, there's so many. And I guess if you think of Facebook and YouTube, they're ahead of the game a little bit. Instagram as well, where they have already set up parameters to avoid that kind of stuff. And Twitter has kind of been the wild, wild west in terms right. of... So I could see that they could follow actual precedent from some of the other social media platforms. But, you know, I mean, there's just a lot going on, right? There's a lot going on Twitter when you talk about people who are not famous or not high profile with, right. with 50 followers or, you know, who want to say something to a politician or want to say something.
And it's not just, you know, saying something. I think we kind of forget the idea that, oh, well, why don't you just stop listening to them, or why don't you just block them? Or it's, you know, tweeting you pictures of the, you know, worst... you know, awful pictures of violence and gore and all these kinds of things. And yes, you could block one, but then another one keeps popping up. And at what point do you stop and say, this is actually not doing anything for me anymore?
Yeah, right.
And that's, I think, one of the things that Twitter has started to realize is that their growth is not because people don't understand how to use Twitter. It's not like people have like not figured out how to thread tweets. It's, oh, there's actually Nazis here, and there are, you know, people being awful racist and you know, sexist and misogynist and all these various ists. And at some point, you say, you know, if that was a bar, you would stop going to that bar. You know, you would just be like, I really like the drinks here, but there are a lot of Nazis here and a fair amount of white supremacists. And
fair amount.
I think I'm just going to go to a different. I'm just not going to come to this bar anymore.
People realize that, right?
And it just particularly for people of color, particularly for women, it's far, far worse. So at some point, I think Twitter started to realize, oh, this is sort of throw open the doors and let the tweets flow kind of approach has made it the usefulness for Twitter or of Twitter for some people just kind of gone away.
Yeah. And obviously the big elephant in the room is the president. The president has been an avid user.
Yeah,
of
that's,
Twitter.
That's an avid user. That's a
and has done exactly some of the things that yeah. Twitter's cracking down on, the incendiary stuff and online bullying and what have you. I mean, obviously they're not going to do anything to his account, but I wonder how much response there's going to be from Trump followers and from Trump supporters that see this to be a biased move by Twitter to clean up what they see or deem to be bad speech or bad behavior.
Yeah, I mean, I think that it's Twitter is in a situation where, you know, they sort of can't win. You know, I mean, if they take even the slightest steps toward you know, cracking down on hate speech, people are going to cry censorship. So it really doesn't matter how delicate the move is that they make. You know, they're going to get
true,
those cries
yeah.
anyway, because
right.
it's sort of, look, if you are speaking to a group of people who seems like they are oppressed in some way or that their views are belittled, what better way to kind of rile those folks up to say, like, look at this huge tech company with all this money. They are trying to get
take
rid
away
of you.
Your voice,
like,
yeah.
we are the haven for you at Breitbart or wherever it is.
Yeah.
So, I mean, you're just going to continue to have those folks who are going to make hay out of whatever you do. So is it better to at least be able to create a space that hews a little bit more towards what you wanted to do, which is create a place that, you know, people can have, you know, decent conversations and discuss the news of the day and that kind of thing.
Yeah.
So
Scott Smith in studio. He's our new media contributor. When we talk about social media, we have to also mention Facebook. Big story today, which was a little bit of a head scratcher because you and me both thought this already happened at one point. But they said they're going to start demoting posts where people are just fishing for likes.
Right. So we've seen this whole thing where, you know, comment if you this or like this post if you something else, you know, that kind of thing.
Or my yeah. posts over and over. Do I look pretty?
Right, right.
I
yeah.
that one over and over.
I saw yours
yeah.
last week.
That yeah,
was,
I haven't blocked
yeah.
it yet. That's
I liked
good.
It.
That's
I
good.
Said I liked it, yeah. yeah, you know, this is interesting to me for two reasons. One, yeah, I kind of already thought that other algorithmic changes they made had kind of knocked this off. But it comes on the heels of a study that surprisingly Facebook actually talked about on its official company blog that said it was a couple different studies. One, that said that the headline most people went with was, you know, using Facebook makes you depressed. And that's not just if you're looking at your ex's Facebook profile. It's just in general. But what they found is that people who use Facebook in this very sort of surface way, like they kind of scroll and scroll, and they might like some things or they might click on some links, but they don't actually engage with it in any meaningful way. Like they don't leave comments or they don't post terribly meaningful updates. Right, they don't actually talk to people, if you will.
Right.
You know, then those people are more likely to be depressed. But people who are actually getting into it and having conversations, and maybe they are in sort of groups, you know, Facebook groups with people who share their interests,
sure,
and have found their own niche communities, those folks actually report that they enjoy Facebook more.
Me and Mike McNamara from the Midwest Film Festival will get on Facebook during Bears games to complain. So yeah, I understand. There's a value to it.
Right. Now one, there has not been a study that shows people who are on Facebook during Bears games, if they are more depressed. There has not been that study. I want to clarify. But yeah, look, having somebody to kind of talk about something like that, and go back and forth, you do get that kind of social interaction.
Well, isn't that the whole, the kind of, I mean, dopamine that's hit. That's the weird thing about this, and why it's still, we're still in the guinea pig phase of social media, because the concept of Facebook is that we're going to connect you. We're going to connect you. We're going to have friends. Mm-hmm. We're going to make your life more enriched by having connections with your friends and family, right? That's the concept. That's the ideal. Yeah. And now studies come out saying it's actually doing the opposite. And a Facebook exec, which was a dumb story from last week, said, yeah, Facebook's probably, it's tearing society apart.
Right.
I mean,
right.
You're starting to get this idea where there's like, you know, this, maybe this social media experiment is just that maybe we need to get rid of all this stuff.
Well, I think there's a couple of things there, right? I mean, most tech companies and most engineers, I would say even, are sort of approaching things from, engineers are going to say, look, we're going to create the tools, we're going to put the product together. The product is, you know, emotion neutral, it is value neutral. What people do with it is a different concern. Well, that's the concern of the people that are the UX folks down the hall. And you're starting to see actually a lot of technology companies now employing folks in the humanities, folks in you know, behavioral sciences that can actually tell people, look, this is how people are going to use your product. This is what we're kind of, you know, seeing now as these tech companies get their tendrils and, you know, to all manner of society. But the other aspect of it is, too, is that most technology companies and most of the folks that kind of are part of, you know, venture capitalist scenes and things like that have this sort of free market rules all kind of thing, right? And so the market will decide, and this has been kind of what a sort of variation of that argument is what Twitter has used in the past, is that, you know, the folks on the platform will decide what is okay and what is not okay.
Yeah.
And what we've seen is that technology companies can employ these algorithms, but the algorithms are only as good or as bad as the human beings that are creating them. So there is a value system put in place about what kind of voices do you want to make sure kind of rise to the top or which ones don't. You know, but going back to Facebook, in that idea of how you use it, you know, it's going to make you depressed. You know, you think of it like if you were at a really terrible party and you were surrounded by people who were talking, but you were not actually talking with any of them. And you were just sort of over in the corner looking like you were, you know, furiously studying the person's bookshelves or something like that. Like, you'd be like, this is I'm depressed. I need to leave. This is a terrible party. And that's probably the you know, comparison to what Facebook is saying, like somebody that just kind of is hanging out and not really engaging and, you know, da-da-da-da. But, you know, I think you're right. We are in this very beginning phase of looking at the effects of these technology apps. And, what's the value? And look, there are plenty of people who say, you know, I was in a crisis situation. I was dealing with something I didn't know how to deal with. And I reached out online and I found people who helped me through it and I found a real connection there. And that still exists. But when you get to a point where you've said, you know, anybody can put an ad on our platform in any form, and, you know, the only thing we'll say is you can't have too much text on the picture. If that's the only limitation of an ad, you have situations like you had last year where foreign entities can come in and influence the way a particular election is you know, is conducted.
Or at least attempt to do that.
Yeah.
And, you know, whether or not there are any proof, it's the concept that that space that were created, and like you mentioned, free market and everything, right, and what people want out of it, is being co-opted more often than we know. And that leads to the emotional part where you're like, I'm not enjoying this experience because I'm being inundated with stuff that mm-hmm. is trying to get me to think one way or not think one way. And that's not why I signed up for this in the first place. It's not why I signed up for Friendster.
Right.
You know, yeah, when it first started. So Scott Smith in studio, editorial director at Teamworks Media and also our new media contributor. All right. Let's talk about 2018, man. What a year for media. And the biggest story, of course, was the shuttering of digital news product DNA Info and Chicagoist and Gothamist and everything in there. And I read a story, and they continue to pop up, that 2018 looks bleak for digital news. And we're talking about companies that aren't the big dogs, that don't just have an arm. You know, what we've seen is with big gobble-ups where, you know, now you have every TV station has a digital arm. But we're talking about indigenous digital, whether it be BuzzFeed or Gawker, as we saw, who's now defunct. Mm-hmm. It's not the a lot of people say that, and we talked about it after the demise of DNA, that the billionaire route is not sustainable, and right now they still have yet to find a workable system of finance that is going to keep this industry afloat.
Right. I mean, there's been two things. So one is the idea of chasing scale for scale's sake. I think this was the year that the lie was put to that concept. You know, everybody knows that if you throw some, you know, paid dollars at social media, or you get involved with folks who are sort of professionally creating platforms to help kind of boost your traffic, you can get those eyeballs. You can, you know, make sure you have the promise to your advertisers fulfilled. But what you found is, you know, that those folks are still just going to drive by traffic. You know, those folks are not going to develop any kind of loyalty to you. But the other thing is, you know, like most things in digital media, the display market is just, you know, cratering. And programmatic advertising, the idea that you can basically turn all the ads over on your website or your platform over to, you know, robots and a sort of back-end system that allows all of the, there's no direct sales anymore, that you can turn that all over to automation, is driving the price of digital ad down, along with what we've seen over the last couple of years, which is Google and Facebook are now eating up like 80% of digital revenue, because a lot of folks realize they can just go direct to search engines, or Facebook is being the biggest social platform.
Do you think, and I don't want to make, because it's fascinating what you're talking about, but the aside, that one of the things that they did not foresee in the digital news industry at the startup was how predatory Facebook and Google were going to be in gobbling up ads and being able to go for advertisers to go, why don't I just go to search engines? Why do I need to attach it to content? I mean, that's that at a certain point may have been undervalued, or not undervalued, but under aware might be the word, because these companies are eating digital news's lunch.
I think what the biggest thing that publishers did to, you know, hasten their demise was not so much see that Google and Facebook were going to eat up all that revenue, right? Or that, the Facebook was going to be the frenemy and all that kind of stuff. It was deciding that it was okay for platforms like Apple and Facebook and Google to get more control over the interaction they have with the customer. The idea that as long as they continue to get page views and uniques and all that kind of stuff, that they would be able to make that money up in digital revenue and just decide that they could walk away from subscribers and walk away from an actual customer that they had a, you know, ongoing relationship
and
with.
And a proven model.
Right, right. That was, I think, the biggest mistake. And I'm not one of those people that thinks that everything on the internet needs to be free, but I'm also not one of those people who thinks everything needs to be behind a paywall either. I think something like, you know, DNA Info, Chicagoist, that's a very local model. It's really difficult to make that work. Chicagoist was profitable before they were bought by DNA Info, so that was a place that was creating a local model that actually worked, because they were in a bunch of different cities, they had a national market, there was a question of how far you could actually take that. Yeah. But, you know, for most places, you know, they're not going to be big enough to get that kind of scale. The generalist news site is going away. The niche news site is actually the one that's taking its place. And they are realizing, and I say niche, and it's still like, you know, 3 to 5 million uniques a month on the low end, you know, up to, say, even 15 on the high end. But those folks are really realizing that subscriptions are really where they're going to make their money. I just saw today that The Atlantic, which had dropped its paywall, and it is really seen as one of the few digital publishing success stories, particularly around the kind of native content that they do. They're putting their paywall back up again. They are really kind of following, you know, you said their billionaire model doesn't really work. It does if you're Jeff Bezos and you're pushing the Washington Post to have a really tight paywall. And we're seeing sites like the Boston Globe, which are smaller, implement a paywall and
Chicago
actually
Tribune, right?
The Chicago Tribune are reinvigorating the idea that the work they do has value.
Well, let me ask about this. We can wrap after this, but the Sun-Times then falls in, a company that does not have a paywall, that has ads all over the place.
Right.
It needs an upgrade on the website and everything. But a company that Edward Eisendrath and the owners of the Sun-Times have said, hey, we're going to win in the digital space. I mean, they're an outlier in the way that they have a brand, they have subscription, they have everything you're talking about. Mm-hmm. Can 2018's kind of make or break for them, right?
Yeah, this is the year they've, you know, when they got bought, they had about 2 years of runway in the money that they had raised. So 2018's really going to be the year that, you know, by, I would say, the end of the first quarter, they have to demonstrate that they are, like, where they're headed digitally. And the thing that they're going to need to do is demonstrate not just that they're, like, throwing up a paywall and, you know, what have you. They're really going to have to demonstrate an idea of what it is that Sun-Times is about. Eisendrath has said that they are for the working person of Chicago, and somebody needs to be getting their back. That's a great idea to rally around, particularly as all of these other sites are getting gobbled up by these kind of big behemoths and things like that. But they're also going to need to demonstrate that they are filling a niche inside a community or communities. I think they have an opportunity to really, you know, speak to areas of the South and West Side that often do not get the kind of coverage, and certainly aren't getting the kind of coverage now that DNA Info has gone away, that, you know, really makes a thriving community. I mean, I see it. I live in the South Side. I live in Morgan Park. And we have a Beverly Review, which has been there for 100 plus years, but we also had DNA Info down there too. And I've seen the kind of, you know, vacuum that occurs in a neighborhood when you don't have news kind of regularly being fed into the people that live there. It's not just about usefulness. It's not just about knowing what's going on in your community, but it's actually being connected to it in a way that makes you feel like, you know, you've got some agency over kind of the world around you. And I think if the Sun-Times can demonstrate that, look, we are not just here to throw news at you. We are actually here to be hearing from you and actually be creating something that has a level of utility for people who live in Chicago, then I think they're going to be really successful.
My last question, since I will probably not see you, New Year's Eve, are you going with the new NBC product, or are you sticking with Davies and Gene Greco?
I'm a Davies and Gene Greco. Old school, man. Come on. Oh, I always, you know. Hey, look, there was a year that Jose Sanders showed up in those really, like, amazing cuffs.
Yeah, the cuffs.
Yeah. I mean, that was just like, this is what the reward you get as a fan for sticking with it. Sticking with the team, you know. I'm going to be there, man. I'm going to be live tweeting from my couch. That's how I do New Year's Eve, man.
I'm
over 40. That's my jam
that
right now,
your
man.
Jam.
That's, you know, Channel 5. You know, I'm sorry that the Superstar
Rising,
Town.
Yeah.
I don't know what is it. Yeah, the Chi-Town Rising. I couldn't remember.
Yeah,
it didn't stick in my head. Yeah. No, I'm a Gene Greco and Davies, Jose
OG.
Sanders.
All right.
The best party is always wherever Jose Sanders is, though.
Yeah.
You know this.
Right.
That's wherever he ends up.
That's
him and Val Warner are going to be out there. You know, that's where it's going to be at.
I'm looking forward to it. Scott Smith, of course, our new media contributor here on The Download and the editorial director over at TeamWorks Media. Scott, thanks so much, man.
Happy New Year, my friend.